The recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPM, in All GTLDs PDP Working Group Call, held on the 14th of December 2016. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. So if you were only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleiman. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. Hello, everyone. This is Kathy Kleiman, one of the co-chairs of this working group. I see Phil Corwin. Another co-chair has joined us, and we are expecting J. Scott Evans, our third co-chair, to join us. Thank you for joining us during this busy holiday season. I know we have a million other things to do, but today's meeting is an important one. Let me pause for a second to see if anybody has an update to their statement of interest. Okay. Not hearing any, please feel free to circulate them on the list and, of course, to post them into the statement of interest that ICANN puts on the website. Okay. Let me give a quick summary for anyone who did not join us at the last meeting. When last we met, we were going over charter questions, a draft of charter questions, a final list of suggested charter questions that had been provided to us by a subgroup that had been working hard over a number of weeks. This was the charter questions subgroup, and it was a group of five or six people who were working pretty hard over the last few weeks to try to bring together a diverse set of questions that came to us from a charter, trying to provide some clarity to some of the questions that we found ambiguous, and trying to provide some neutrality, particularly in cases where questions kind of suggested an answer, and there still seem to be some underlying issues about, you know, what are the facts, what's happening, what's the problem, and then, you know, do we want to get to an answer? And in some cases, there were questions coming in on two different sides, trying to push in two different directions for an answer. So, again, trying to neutralize the question so we can look at both sides of it or see what the evidence provides. According to our wonderful staff member, Mary Wong, and you guys need to, we've lost David Tate now, who has gone on to another job in the UK working on Brexit issues. So according to Mary, we were on Category 1, Question 4. Category 1 is the guidance questions, guidance kind of looking at big picture guidance questions for the TMCH providers. And so we were on the design mark question. So what I'd like to propose, unless there's any objections, is where we continue where we left off, try to make it through the entire document and then go back to some of the revisions and questions still raised about the first three questions in Category 1 that we worked on last week. But again, unless anybody objects, I'd recommend we kind of continue through the end of the document, see what we can put to bed, and then come back and work on all the questions that still remain. Great. And if we make it through all of this, we get to look at some of the data gathering, some of the responses that the registries provided to some of the questions that we put out for data on the Trademark Clearinghouse and its use. Okay. So number four, is everyone in charge of their own slides, Mary, or are you going to be rotating us through them? It looks like everyone's in charge of their own. Good. Okay. So number four is how are design marks currently handled by the provider? And then there's a note. Note, the working group is using the more commonly used term design marks to refer to what the TMCH guidelines describe as device or image marks, or otherwise marks that do not excessively, I believe that word should be exclusively, consist of letters, words, numbers, numerals, special characters, having trouble reading my notes, special characters, e.g., see the Trademark Clearinghouse Guidelines on page 20. So this wording and the additions that staff has provided in redline reflect the discussion last week that the Trademark Clearinghouse and the community seem to use different terms to talk about design marks. And if we rephrase the question with the clarifying note, we've got both sets of descriptions. So let me first – we do have related questions on – on geographic indicators, designations of origin, et cetera. But let me pause to see if anyone objects to the way the question is currently phrased on design marks. Great. Then we'll go. We'll see if anyone objects on the list. But pending that, we'll go forward with this as question four, with the change from excessively to exclusively. So now I'd like to ask if anyone would like to speak to, and I see some of the people who raised questions, issues, a related issue to design marks, which has been raised by people responding to this question and maybe pointing out that there should be a new question or a related question on geographic indicators, appellations of origin, so and designation of origin. Would anyone like to speak to that and speak to the concern that they're seeing and perhaps phrase a neutral question on how the working group might look at that? Matthew and Massimo both submitted comments. I could read them, but if they're on the list, I think it might be better if they could come on. Massimo, do you have telephone access? Okay. Would anybody like to speak to these? Let me read what was posted, and perhaps people can suggest how we should handle this. So Matthew Wheel on December 3rd, apologies if I mispronounced that, had questions about geographic indicators. How are geographic indications and or appellations, designations of origin, handled by the TMCH provider? He'd like to know how many such registrations were submitted and approved. Massimo Vittori submitted on December 13th a question about design marks, a data gathering question, really. How many design marks and marks protected by statute or treaty have been submitted and validated? And what is your criteria for validating these? And then he'd like to know, under the marks protected by statute or treaty, how many applicants base their requests on titles such as geographical indications, protected designation of origin, and or appellation of origin? Go ahead, Massimo. I'm glad you're in the queue. Thank you.
And this is Terry from staff. Your mic is not active. So to activate your mic on the top toolbar, select the telephone icon and follow the prompt. Or if you send me a private Adobe Connect chat, I'm happy to have the operator dial out to you with a provided phone number.
Okay, we're still not seeing input, although we are hearing somebody typing. If you're not on mute, if you could please mute. Okay. Christine Durant, please go ahead. And Massimo, hopefully you'll have audio soon. Christine, please go ahead.
Hi, Christine from Amazon Registry. Thanks, Kizzy. I don't want to step all over what Massimo might be planning to say, but I'm just looking at, I read the email string, and I'm looking at the comments box here on question four, and I'm wondering if we want to kind of include geographical indications as something that we investigate. I think it's pretty easily added by saying how are design marks or geographical indications currently handled by the trademark clearinghouse provider. Because although Massimo asks some very good follow-up questions, the follow-up questions are along the lines of the types of things that the team will get into, the types of questions that the team would ask, having been on the quieter, the smaller TMCH review team. We got into those really detailed questions. You know, what did we want to find out? What did we want to know? So, I mean, to the extent that geographic indicators are something people want to know about or think that is within the scope of the charter question, I think it's pretty easily added by just adding the words geographical indicators and you know, going from there. And you know, we can mince words over whether geographical indicators is the right word. I'm using this as a, you know, concept. So maybe people could talk a little bit about, you know, just the right wording to include, not the questions and how we're going to get there. Thanks.
Thanks, Christine. Massimo, do we have you?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Please go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, man, I'm sorry. First time I take the floor, so I was a little bit with technology. I was having some trouble. My point is the following, that we have some of our members of Origin, which are geographical indications owners or beneficiaries, which have submitted requests to be part of the Thermal Clearing House, basing, you know, their requests on a geographical indications title. But, you know, in some jurisdictions, these are called appellation of origins, in other designations of origin. So my point was that, can we know exactly how many submissions were based on geographical indications appellation of origins? And I know for sure that one at least was accepted as such, according to the regulation. So just to know exactly how many were accepted. And so I tend to also agree. I mean, we don't need to give all the details I have put in my proposed questions, but the final point would be to know how many people tried to register some marks based on treaty and statutes, and how many were accepted, and if there were a difference in the way those applications were managed, if some were rejected, for instance. That's my point. So,
Massimo, please don't leave. Let me ask you a few questions and see if this would suffice. As Christine mentioned, it's probably easy to include your question, but I'd recommend perhaps including it as a different question, because the design marks do seem to be different than the geographic indicators. So how would you feel, and then we'll ask the working group, about a question that says, how does the TMCH handle geographic indicators, and we can say parentheses, also called appellations of origin and designations of origin, question mark, and then we can include the data gathering underneath the broader question. I mean, it's kind of implicit that if we're looking into the question, we'll be asking for data on it, like how many registrations have been tracked.
I totally agree. Actually, I think the first Matuveo, like, plugged in into question four, and I followed up, you know, adding details into question four, but I perfectly understand that would be better to have an independent question only on geographical indications. I agree.
Fantastic. So let's propose it as a 4A now, but ultimately it might become 5. Thank you for the discussion. It looks like Christine is back in the queue. Christine, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Christine, Amazon Registry Services. I support the first part of your amendment, Kathy, but I do want to push back a little bit on leaving the itemized question in, only because I have a feeling we're going to get into the weeds. If we leave Massimo's wonderful questions in the charter question itself, then there are going to be 5 people who are going to raise their hand and want their own questions and their own data gathering activities added into the charter question. So I do suggest that we not put any of the data gathering questions into the charter question, reserve those for when we get to that action item, and then we can add any additional data gathering questions that anybody has. And I do point out that Mary suggested that we had already asked this question of the TMCH, which I thought we had, but I wasn't sure. So,
Christine, hold on. I don't think we're in a different place. Let me just double check that the question that would be added is, how does the TMCH handle geographic indicators, also called, you know, the other two versions? And then we leave all the data gathering questions as implicit within the question.
Yes, agreed. Thanks, Kathy.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. Massimo, your hand is still raised. Would you like to continue the discussion? Okay. Would anyone else like to comment on this?
No, it's okay. I will remove my lower hand. It's okay.
Okay.
I'm okay with it.
Okay, fantastic. And when we get to this question, which again is, and I'm not sure I see it in the notes, but the notes are pretty small. How does how does the TMCH handle geographic indications? when we get there, then hopefully you'll work with us on the data gathering questions that would be related to that. Okay, that covers 4 and 4A, unless others have anything to add. Terrific. Then we move along to question 5. What information on the following aspects of the operation of the TMCH is available and where can it be found? : TMCH services, contractual relationships between the TMCH providers and private parties, and with whom does the TMCH share data and for what purposes? And the note from the staff suggests that some of this has to do with the co-chair's paper on private protection mechanisms, which we'll be talking about probably next week. But there were a lot of questions raised in the charter and I believe in Helsinki and perhaps in India on how is the TMCH database being used? Do we understand the full scope of the use of this data that ICANN has caused to be collected? And so if we get to the registry responses later today, we'll see a number of questions that a different subgroup, the data gathering subgroup, kind of put out to find on this. But this is the charter question that urges us to kind of, that combines, as you can see, there's a great effort here to combine a number of questions and put them all in one place and look at this all together. How, you know, what are the TMCH services, what are the contractual relationships, and how is the data being used? Seems like a very fair, reasonable question. Anybody have any objections or changes? Great. Check. Moving on, we're again not accepting it absolutely, but accepting it with the 42 participants of the call, and we'll put it out to the list in case anyone wants to share anything else. We now move on to what's tentatively been called Category 2, verification and updating of the TMCH data. And anyone point out, I'm using hard copy notes, so if for whatever reason they differ from what Mary has for us, please let me know. Okay, so Category 2, should there be an additional or a different recourse mechanism to challenge rejected trademarks? Now, I urge the subgroup to help me with this, the charter question subgroup, because I think when we talk about rejected trademarks, because there's another question about canceled trademarks right below, I think what we're talking about here is trademarks rejected by the TMCH provider. So, again, let me read the question as tentatively revised. I'm not trying to be biased. I'm just trying to be clear. Should there be an additional or a different recourse mechanism to challenge trademarks rejected by the TMCH provider? Of course, that would open the questions of what has been rejected, what is the process, and perhaps should there be some kind of appeals mechanism if we find this to be a problem. Okay, I see support in the chat room. Can we specify this as reject for recording in the TMCH? Okay, does anybody object to the wording? So again, trademarks rejected by the TMCH provider. Does anyone want to comment on this question? Okay, then question 2 of this Category 2, verification and validation of TMCH data, is how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH, that should probably be the TMCH database, to avoid discouraging or losing domain name registration? Is this satisfactory? So the underlying questions, as you can imagine, were concerned with a trademark that might be canceled in its underlying trademark, in the trademark office. We've had some famous examples in the United States of this. And so there was it was posited that the longer a canceled trademark was in the TMCH database, the longer it might be used in sunrise periods and to stop someone else from having, you know, from being able to record or being able to register a domain name. Christine, go ahead.
Hi, I feel like this was the Christine and Kathy show today.
That's a good show, KK. I like it.
It is. Yeah, I agree. Christine from Amazon, I have just a question on this, just basically what this is intending to say. I don't understand this concept of losing domain name registrations. I wonder if that's meant to be sort of from the registry perspective and that the registry or the registrar loses out on a registration. Maybe this isn't coming from the perspective of the customer losing a registration. I just maybe wonder if we want to be a little more precise with our language because I'm not entirely sure what this is supposed to say.
Christine, do you want to suggest some language? And I don't want to out him, although I might. I know who wrote this language, and he is on the list. He's a member of our subgroup, of course. And so I'm hoping he's going to join the queue and talk about this particular language at the end of the question that you pointed out. But, Christine, do you want to offer kind of where you – it sounds like you want to delete some words at the end of the question. So would you like to kind of offer what you'd like to see it as?
Yeah, I guess I was still just trying to understand. So I'm guessing that this is from the perspective of a registrar. So I'm suspecting we need to say how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the trademark clearinghouse to avoid discouraging new registrations or preventing... Or, yeah, I don't even know. Isn't losing a domain name registration the same as preventing it? Because you're not going to lose an already registered name. So discouraging or preventing domain name registrations, maybe that's what it's trying to say. Let me see what George is writing. What might cause the prospective registrant to abandon their shopping cart and thus losing a potential? Yeah, I think that's right. So
let me read it back to you, Christine. How quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database to avoid discouraging or preventing new registrations? It looks like I see Mary, Kurt, and others typing. Okay, Mary points out that the question is the same as what was in the charter. Okay, I didn't realize it hadn't been changed by the subteam because we talked about it extensively. She says it was suggested in a comment to the preliminary issues report. So, Mary, would you like to come online and comment from a staff perspective as to what you think as to whether you think the change that Christine offered changes the substance, because you've dealt with the issues report longer than anyone else. Go ahead. Thanks.
Hi, Kathy, everyone. This is Mary. I'm not sure I can add any more illumination because this question was basically reflecting the suggestion that was made by a commenter to the preliminary issue report. So in that sense, it is what it was when it was suggested, and as I pointed out, the subteam didn't make any changes to it.
Oh, on further reflection, this is Kathy again, of course, losing. Could that refer, and again, bringing the whole working group into trying to decipher the tea leaves of the charter questions is what the subgroup's been trying to do for a long time now, and now we're all trying to do it. But could losing the domain name registration also refer to the URS, since what's in the TMCH database is being used in the URS? So if you have a canceled trademark, it creates problem. If you have a canceled trademark that has not been removed from the TMCH database, it both can discourage or prevent new registrations, but it might also cause a problem regarding losing a registration if it's been challenged in a domain name dispute. Christine, please go ahead.
Thanks, Christine from Amazon. I think that's a fair interpretation, actually. I think that's a good catch, and we may just want to clarify it. I mean, simply changing it to how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the trademark clearinghouse. Now, George is suggesting that we really don't even need to have the rest of it. We're at this point just guessing at the problems if we don't quickly remove a trademark from the clearinghouse. Problems such as discouraging or domain name registrations or losing domain name registrations to URS. So one option, I guess, as proposed by George, is just to simply leave it at the end of TMCH and be done. Alternatively, I think if we leave the losing language, I think adding a parenthetical suggesting via URS or something like that would at least clarify so that in a couple of months when we come back to this question in detail, at least we'll know what we're talking about.
Clarifications are always welcome, no question about it. Well, let's do a quick straw poll, and that way we can move on to the next question. So who's in favor of shortening the question? And I'll read it, and I'm going to add back in the word database just because TMCH is so vague. We use it in so many ways. So how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database? That's option one. And otherwise, how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database to avoid discouraging or losing domain name registrations, with the parentheses that losing refers to URS and other domain name disputes. So all in favor of option one, the short version, please check or raise your hand. Mary, if you could count. And we'll give everyone a few seconds to look up from other things people are doing and vote. So option one, the short version. Okay, Mary, do you have a count? I have one, but I'll trust yours.
It looks like nine, but I might need to scroll down again because the check marks actually go down the page. So I don't know if anyone else has raised their hand since I last counted, but it would be at least, I think now more hands have gone up. But you were probably at least a quarter of the people who are on the call today. And Kathy, if I may make a suggestion, which is a follow-up to Christine's as well.
We're voting, Mary, so I'm gonna stay with this right now. So option one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, if everyone could cancel out. And we'll go on to option two. Thanks, and I'll talk for a second as everyone's canceling out. Okay, option two, the full original question with additional clarifying information about the losing being part of the URS and domain name. How quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database to avoid discouraging or losing domain name registrations with the clarifying URS? So this is the original preliminary issues report question. Who supports this? And we'll give this a second. Christine and Lori, do you want to comment on this? Or we're going to finish the vote, everybody. And then one, two, three.
No, I'm sorry. That was an old hand.
Okay. Okay. It looks like the shorter version has it. Mary, go ahead, and then Lori, I'll call on you, and then Phil Corin.
Thanks, Kathy. It was really just a note that since we've asked, or at least the sub-team for data gathering has asked the provider a related question about the process by which they handle these trademarks, we can always come back to this question if we need to refine it later on in time. Thanks.
Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. Phil, for the record, I'm just not clear on why the URS reference is being thrown in. One, if there's a possibility of losing it, you could lose the if you register the domain, it could be subject to a UDRP or a URS. So maybe we should use the, dare I say, generic DRP. But second, what are the odds of a former trademark owner bringing such an action on the basis of a canceled trademark, and if the URS and UDRP are operating properly, shouldn't that action just be dismissed if there's no valid trademark?
Good point. But Phil, it looks like we've deleted all of that. Is that okay with you? That the question now is based on the vote, how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. I was responding to the comments regarding URS made just 2 minutes ago.
Good points. Good points all. Thank you.
Thanks.
Lori, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now. Thank you.
Yes. Sorry. I'm on the phone. I couldn't get into the mic on Adobe Connect. I guess I had heard you say something about the use of the TMCH is vague in the question, and that's what I had a confusion about, since TMCH is very clearly the clearinghouse. So I wasn't sure what made use of the term vague. That's all.
I'm sorry. Lori, does TMCH database, if we add the word database, does that help you with that question? So the question now, it looks like, as it's adopted, is how quickly can and should a canceled trademark be removed from the TMCH database?
Yeah, I guess it doesn't matter one way or the other. I just didn't find it vague the first place, and I didn't understand what the vagueness was about. Because isn't the clearinghouse by definition a database? Is there anything else but the database, I guess would be my question.
There are TMCH providers. There are TMCH RPMs. So I don't know.
All right. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. It looks like we are now done, unless anybody has any other comments. Category 2, verification and updating of TMCH data, now has two questions, one about challenging rejected marks and one about canceled trademarks. And absent any other comments, we go on to Category 3, balance. Before I read this question, let me just pause and thank the subgroup for spending hours, days, trying to gel and distill a number of questions down to what we thought was the essence and presenting it to you. So know that there's a lot of work behind what I'm about to read. We're on, again, Category 3, balance, number 1. Does the scope of the TMCH and the protection mechanisms which flow from it reflect the appropriate balance between the rights of trademark holders and the legitimate rights of non-trademark registrants? And I will pause to see if there's anyone who wants to discuss this, any concerns, any edits, or whether the work of the subgroup goes forward. And I'll wait as people are typing into the chat room. George writes, question 3.1 is describing in broad terms our entire charter, with a smiley face. Agreed, George. Okay. We can, of course, always go back to this in this discussion in our second pass or on the list. But it looks like we're moving on to Category 3, balance, question 2. And this is, of course, one that's had a lot of discussion on the list. Should the scope of the TMCH be limited to apply only to the categories of goods and services in which the generic terms within a trademark are protected? If so, how? So yesterday a proposal came from the co-chairs, and let me read that. Should the scope of the TMCH be limited to apply only to the categories of goods and services in which the dictionary term, parentheses S, within a trademark are protected? If so, how? Note, in responding to this question, you should note that the original submitters of the related charter question seem to have been particularly concerned about, quote-unquote, generic terms representing the common or class name for the goods and services. And I am going to open this up. Phil, please go ahead.
Yeah, Kathy, thank you. In the course of some back and forth on the email list yesterday, the version of the question. Some questions were raised about what the scope of the TMCH mean, and I proposed a clarification of the question, of the co-chair's suggestion, which seemed to be acceptable to resolve that ambiguity. So let me read that. It's just the first sentence, and it should, the scope of the RPMs associated with the TMCH be limited to apply only to TLDs that are related to the categories of goods and services in which the dictionary terms within the trademark are protected. So in other words, that would say if you're got a mark that's registered for a certain class of goods and services, should the should your right for Sunrise registrations be limited solely to those new TLDs that are somehow related to the goods and services, and likewise, should claims notices only be generated from some of those? Now, there was a comment, I don't know if he wants to comment orally, but Greg Shatton, just a little while ago in the email, said that he was fine with that clarification, but he thought now the question should be in a different place, in a different category. So I don't know if Greg wants to speak to that, but I did want to read out the latest version of that, which had circulated on the list yesterday.
Phil, before you leave the call, and as you know, I've been traveling a lot lately, let me ask you a question, because if this question is modified the way you suggest, then it will probably move to the future charter questions that we'll be reviewing for the Sunrise period and trademark claims. But could it be limiting? Is there anything within the scope of the TMCH database that is not within the scope of the RPMs? And here I'm thinking private purposes as well. So could there be implications of something being in the TM uses? Could there be reasons to keep it at this level rather than, as well as pushing it down to the rights protection mechanisms, rather than keeping it here as well as keeping it in Sunrise?
Kathy, I'll leave that to the rest of the working group to decide. All I'm saying, and I think it's a valid concern, that the phrase scope of the TMCH without some additional words is not really very clear. The TMCH doesn't have a scope. You either meet the criteria and you're registered in it, or you're not. What has scope is the range of the protections which flow from TMCH registration. So it's an attempt to get at the effect of some special treatment for dictionary words and their generic meaning. So I'll stop there and let this was a topic of great interest. So let's see if others have something to say about it.
It was indeed. Thank you, and thank you for all the revisions that you and so many others on the group have been working on. Mary, it looks like your hand is raised.
Yes, Kathy. I just wanted to draw the group's attention, especially for folks on the bridge, to some discussion that's going on in the Adobe chat. There's actually two discussions. One goes back to the earlier question, so maybe I'll park that for now, Kathy, while we talk about this question too. But on this specific question, I believe there was a question from Beth that asked about Phil's reformulation concerning the use of the word related, as in what that means and who's going to determine what that means. And there is a suggestion from Paul Tattersfield that we should change the phrase dictionary term simply to the words. Kathy, I don't know if you can see that in chat, but those are the two comments that I've picked up, including the discussion that's going on about the previous question about the word legitimate.
Mary, could you go back to the first comment about the word relating and which version of the question does that go
to? It refers to the reformulation by Phil, and I see that Beth has a hand up, so maybe, Beth, would you like to explain your question and comment?
Yeah, Beth Allegretti. So the comment was that registrations be limited to the goods or services that are related to the GTLD, if I understood that correctly. And I'm just wondering who would make that determination, because it's kind of subjective. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
I think that would be part of the evaluation that would be done by as part of the evaluation of this question of the working group. But the question from the charter was pretty clear, which is, are trademarks being protected outside the categories of goods and services in which the trademark gives them protection? So, Beth, I agree. It's a hard call, but the evaluation seems like a fair question to ask, and we were certainly asked it numerous times in the charter. Who would like to actually join the discussion and raise some of the edits? It's much easier to talk about edits if someone comes onto the call rather than trying to negotiate with the chat room. So let me read the version from Phil, and Mary, go ahead.
Sorry, Kathy. There was the other comment by Paul Tattersfield, I believe. I don't know if, Paul, you want to speak to it. But his suggestion on the edited question is not to use the phrase dictionary term. And there's a bit of a discussion as to what should replace it in the Adobe.
Again, I'm going to urge – I actually have a hard time reading the small print in the chat room, guys. I'm going to urge people to come onto the call and talk about this, because dictionary term was heavily negotiated. That was – people are concerned about these kind of basic words, generic terms, dictionary terms that are trademarked in some uses, but as Phil pointed out in some of the descriptive emails over the last few days, not trademarked and heavily used dictionary terms in others, like Apple. So let me read the version that Phil circulated, and should the scope of the RPMs associated with the TMCH be limited to apply only to TLDs that are related to the categories of goods and services in which the dictionary term or terms within a trademark are protected? Lots of discussion in the chat room. Come on onto the call. Okay, Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, given the surprising silence on this, I think we should take silence as consent if no one's going to be really objecting to the current formulation, because people are going to give whatever answers they want to give anyway, no matter how precisely we try to formulate the question. But the thrust of the question is simply, let me give a well-known example that's used all the time. Apple is the name. It's the dictionary name of a fruit. Nobody has the right to call themselves. Nobody who raises the fruit apple has the right to trademark. We are the Apple Company for apples, because it's a generic term. But there's this well-known company named Apple, which makes all kinds of electronics. So the question is really, if Apple registers Apple in the Trademark Clearinghouse, should it have the right for Sunrise registrations in every new TLD, or only in the ones that are related to the goods and services for which Apple is registered? And should potential registrants only get trademark claims notices from TLDs that are related to those goods and services, or from every TLD? And I already put in my opinion yesterday that I'm probably going to answer this question no, for two reasons. One, it'd be a very difficult task for the Trademark Clearinghouse to. Someone's going to have to decide for each registered mark. It's going to have to look at its goods and services, which may be categorized in different jurisdictions in which the mark is registered. They use different words for it in different languages. Which TLDs relate to those goods and services, which is a subjective judgment. And second, there could be, if there's a TLD, and I don't remember all the TLDs, if there's a TLD.computer, there could be a valid registration by someone who's not associated with Apple Corporation of Apple.computer if the purpose is for fair use commentary on the features and pluses and minuses of Apple products, and someone could register an infringing domain related to electronic goods at some other TLD that's not related to Apple goods and services, and then drive traffic to it through various search engine optimization techniques. So that would be my answer, but I hope it's clear what the question is getting at. Right now, every TLD, if someone tries to register a exact match of a registered TMCH registered mark, generates a claims notice, and the rights holder has Sunrise registration rights in every TLD. The question is really saying, should that be narrowed?
Thank you for the clarification, Phil. I'm seeing agreement with you in the chat room.
Okay.
Thanks. Bradley Silver is next in the queue.
Thanks, Kathy. This is Bradley. I had a little bit of a different question. Actually, are we talking about 3.1 or 3.2 before I weigh in? Because there is activity in the chat room about both.
We are talking about 3.2, and we're in the third column under, at the very bottom of the third column, it's a long column, Phil Corwin, 13 December, should the scope of the RPMs associated with the TMCH be limited to apply only to the TLDs that are related to the categories of goods and services in which the dictionary terms within a trademark are protected?
All right, I'm going to put my hand down for now then. If we come back to 3.1 and there's discussion about how to tweak that, I will weigh in then.
So okay.
There's the flow on 3.2.
Great. I am going to actually – can we queue up – well, let's – I'll make a note about 3.1. But 3.2, I'm going to go with Phil's suggestion that silence is probably a good sign, and that we will – that it looks like the group is accepting the second version that he sent around, the version I just read, in the third column of 3.2 that he sent late yesterday, the one I've read several times. Mary, can we take that as the current version now of 3.2? And my thought would be to keep plowing through and go back to 3.1 later, but it looks like there's discussion now, so let me reopen 3.1, and I'll read it again. So we're in Category 3 balance. We're going back to the prior question that we were discussing. Does the scope of the TMCH and the protection mechanisms which flow from it reflect the appropriate balance between the rights of trademark holders and the legitimate rights of non-trademark registrants? Actually has a lot to do with the question 3.2 as well. Bradley, go ahead.
Thanks. I think there might be two points here. I'd raised the point about what legitimate means, and others in the chat room raised the point about, well, what rights are we talking about when we make reference to non-trademark registrants? Back to what Phil was saying about 3.2, we're not necessarily need to be completely precise. We're trying to elicit answers and information. So my suggestion for 3.1 is that I don't know if it's going to be necessary to describe in great detail about exactly what rights we're talking about when we make reference to non-trademark registrants. I was just wondering about why we make the distinction between rights of trademark owners on the one hand and legitimate rights of non-trademark registrants on the other, and maybe we should just refer to rights and let folks respond in a manner that supports their answer.
Bradley, can you hold on a second? Let me share some of the subgroup discussion as well as some of the charter and see if that makes a difference, because there is we had questions coming in, both in the charter and in Helsinki, where there are multiple sides that feel that their concerns and issues should be reviewed as part of this review process. Trademark owners are one, but also the domain name registrants are the other. And so rather than coming up with a series of questions, one set for trademark owners and one set for current and future and potential registrants, we combined it to show, to come up with the balance question. And so that was the illustration of rights on both sides. And as Phil was talking about, that could include the ability to use Apple to critique and discuss Apple, kind of some of the fair use issues. So this was the most neutral wording the subgroup could come up with.
Yeah, I don't have an issue with combining the question. I'm just wondering what the word legitimate means when we're talking about the rights of non-trademark registrants. I just, we want to get answers that aren't in the form of questions. And some might say, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question because I'm not sure what the right I'm talking about is legitimate. So either we talk about interests, because that's, I suppose the sort of formulation I've seen most often in talking about the rights of IP owners versus the interests of users, or we talk about the rights of trademark holders and the rights of non-trademark registrants, and not editorialize, any sort of subcategory of rights, like only those which are considered to be legitimate.
So the proposal is to delete the word legitimate so that the question reads about the appropriate balance between the rights of trademark holders and the rights of non-trademark registrants.
Yeah, or I think an equivalent suggestion is one that's in the notes, which is replacing it with legitimate interests, which I think it just is more cogent because we're not talking about rights on the one hand versus legitimate rights on the other hand. I think legitimate interests is a more understandable term when you talk about the interests of non-trademark registrants. I think either would be fine.
Okay. My guess is we're going to be talking about legitimate interests for a long time. Would anybody object to just making the language parallel, deleting legitimate, because we haven't said the legitimate rights of trademark holders? So again, let me read the question as revised. Does the scope of the TMCH and the protection mechanisms which flow from it reflect the appropriate balance between the rights of trademark holders and the rights, deleting the word legitimate, and the rights of non-trademark registrants? Okay, looks like there's agreement. Bradley, your hand is still up, so I'll pause and see if that's an old hand. People are typing, so I'll wait a second. Kieran agrees. Beth agrees. Phil Morano agrees. John agrees. Okay, terrific. 3.1, done. We'll parallel the language on both sides. So delete the word legitimate. So 1 and 3.1 and 3.2, now done. Let's go on to 3.3. Here are two questions, actually 3.3 and 3.4 have to do with some of the matching rules and variation rules. So 3 was a very clear question coming in from the charter. Should the TM plus 50 be retained or removed? And then there's a note, because we found that some people didn't know what the TM plus 50 was, so we asked staff to clarify. So the footnote says, trademark owners can add up to 50 variations that are similar to each valid submission in the TMCH within the notification process, provided that the variant of the mark was awarded to the trademark holder in a prior UDRP case. So up to 50 variations if you can show that the UDRP case involved those variations and that you won. So Kurt is proposing Should the TMCH plus 50 be retained as is, amended, or removed? So adding the words retained as is, amended, or removed. We've got three more minutes. So, Phil, go ahead, please.
Thanks. Phil, for the record, I'm fine with the question as posed or with Kurt's revision. I'm just wondering, shouldn't we also be asking how many marks that are not registered trademarks but were registered under TM plus 50 are in the clearinghouse? Wouldn't that be useful information? I'm not sure if we're asking that elsewhere, but if not, I think we should be asking it here as part of this.
Phil, hold on a second. Would that be a data-gathering question that would be kind of implicit under this question? So once this question goes out, would then kind of a follow-up be to ask the Trademark Clearinghouse about the use of the TM plus 50?
Yeah, that's fine. I just want to make sure that at some point we actually know. Yeah, I don't know whether there's been no marks or 1,000 marks and they're put in the clearinghouse under TM plus 50. This working group ought to have that data at some point.
Absolutely, and I think this question will lead to that kind of information gathering. But good, very good point. Okay, so Phil is ready to accept it as amended by Kurt Pritz or as is. Any thoughts? I'm going to check the chat room on this. Let me ask for any objections to Kurt's revision, and let me read it again. And he's just putting in more variations, which is what the subgroup did. Kurt was on the subgroup team. We just tried to make sure everything was as neutral as possible. Should the TM plus 50 be retained as is, amended, or removed? I think that's a fair expansion. Let's put that in, Mary, as and it looks like there's some support here. Mary, let's put that in as a red line so people can see it. And I think that wraps up our work for today. I'll pause for any other comments that people have. Thank you for running through so many comments, and thank you for the robust discussion on the list this week in preparation for today's call. I know this is hard work, but these will be the questions that we'll be working on for the next 3, 4, maybe more months. So I really appreciate everyone's time and laying them out. So barring any comments, Terry Agnew writes that our next meeting is 2200 UTC on Wednesday, the 21st of December, unless anyone has any objection to holding it that close to the holiday. So thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Appreciate it. Have a good week, everyone.